science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
It is time for Dear Science. How are we, Ellen?
Oh, we're busy, Lillian. We're busy. It's summer school time, so I've got to rush off and give two lectures after this.
And you've just had two lectures.
I've just had two lectures, yes. Yes, no rest and all that.
Is that... I mean, that's a lot of work.
Well, it's a lot of work for the kids, the poor things.
Do you think any of them listen to BFM or listen to your show?
Oof, I don't know. I'll find out after this, I'm sure.
Would they get extra marks if they did?
Doubtless. Yes.
There you go, guys. Actually, we should tell you, this segment is the second highest rated or followed podcast on BFM.
Very
so
cool.
Congratulations. Wow. Oof. That's all you.
I doubt
maybe
that.
Maybe a little bit of world.
Thanks.
Fantastic news. Cool.
We aren't joined by Ruben, actually, I should let you know, because he's been covering another show, so... He's taking a break from Wednesdays.
Fair enough.
Anyway, lightning.
Okay.
First topic. Lightning creating antimatter in the atmosphere.
Indeed.
What does that mean?
Okay. Well, everybody knows that lightning's pretty powerful stuff. And somebody's just, sort of described it as being pure electricity, which it basically is. And you can get sort of temperatures up to 50,000 degrees Celsius and stuff in a lightning strike and, very, very, very highly energetic. And so it's been thought for a while that perhaps it's energetic enough to be able to carry out sort of nuclear reactions, so reactions in the chemical nucleus. And so some Japanese scientists decided to test this. And they did this on the basis that they've known for quite some time that lightning bursts emit these things called gamma rays. And gamma rays are really, 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 really energetic particles, essentially. And when you've got really, really energetic particles, it's possible that they can interact with the chemical nucleus and get it to do weird things, okay? And some of those, one of those weird things is create antimatter, which we'll talk about in a minute. And so what they did was to set up essentially a radiation detector on top of a nuclear power station, of all places, in Japan. And they were monitoring a thunderstorm that was very, very close. And it's kind of difficult to set all this sort of stuff up. So you've got to have, a thunderstorm within Kui. Otherwise, this isn't going to work. So they got lucky. And what they found with the radiation detector was that they were seeing a very short burst of gamma rays. So about 200 milliseconds of gamma rays. And then after that, what they were seeing were some positrons and neutrinos and neutrons. So they were detecting these. Now, okay, what are these things?
What are positrons?
positrons are antimatter.
Okay,
so quick chemistry lesson. Okay, nucleus is made up of protons and neutrons. Okay?
Didn't know that one.
And then surrounding those are electrons. So those are your three basics of matter. Okay, now antimatter are the anti-versions of matter, okay? So instead of protons, we've got antiprotons. Instead of neutrons, we've got antineutrons. And instead of electrons, we've got positrons.
So are they all charged oppositely to regular matter?
Well, the antineutrons aren't, okay? But the antiprotons and the anti-electrons, or the positrons, are. So the positrons are positively charged electrons.
Whoa.
And when a positively charged electron meets a negatively charged electron, then we get annihilation. Okay, so that's antimatter meeting matter, and you get annihilation, and you get emission of gamma radiation and lots of energy.
So when you say annihilation, it's not like a nuclear explosion. They're just cancelling each other out.
What kind of scale?
Yeah, no, you do get a decent amount of energy out of all of this.
But you need a decent amount of energy to create this sort of situation? Is that what you're saying in terms of lightning?
Yes, you do. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so, if you've ever had a PET scan, positron emission tomography scan, so that uses antimatter. That uses positrons and the interactions of these with actual matter. And then you get the radiation that emits from that, and that gives you pictures sort of the inside of your body. So that's...
I did not know that.
Ah, okay. It's always good when I tell Will something he doesn't know. I'm happy about that, because Will knows a bit,
I know some things, I'll tell you what.
You do.
I know at least three things. Because I always thought, when I think about the antimatter, I've seen it on TV and things like that, it's always talked about as this mysterious thing that's in space, and it does all this crazy stuff, but we're utilizing it to... For medicine and
yes,
things like that.
Yes, absolutely.
I did not know that.
Yeah,
someone's going to laugh at me, but I don't care.
And well, I didn't know what PET scan stood stood for. So there we go.
Okay, so that's okay. So we've
someone all, can laugh at me as well.
We've all learned something. Okay, and so yeah, sort of the guts of this is that the way that these positrons and neutrons and stuff get emitted is these gamma rays hit the nuclei of, in particular, nitrogen atoms and oxygen atoms in the atmosphere. And when it does that, then they, once they've turned into other isotopes of nitrogen and oxygen, they then emit these, what we call subatomic particles or whatever, and those are the ones that get detected. And the nitrogen turns into carbon and the oxygen turns into nitrogen. It's all very interesting. All very
inverted.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
So are they...
No, go.
Are they trying to harness this kind of energy or?
No, they're not, but they're just sort of interested in the fact that this happens, and now they've got a possible way to account for the formation of these unusual isotopes of carbon and nitrogen in the atmosphere. So,
and is that, are they damaging to our atmosphere or?
No, they're okay. They're okay. They're not radioactive or anything like that. So it's just carbon 13 and nitrogen 15. They're just very uncommon isotopes of both carbon and nitrogen. And so now it's been shown that basically these can be formed by lightning, where we in the laboratory have to do it and, you know, in cyclotrons and, you know, all these big, expensive, enormous apparatus. Nature can just do it by itself, which, you know, nature is pretty good at. So
wow,
yeah. So it's
lightning.
It's kind of cool.
You said near the beginning that this was, you know, lightning is one of the purest forms of electricity.
Yeah.
When you said that, is there like non-pure
electricity? No. It's pure electricity. I think I said. So I think I was just paraphrasing somebody. Yeah. So
good fact checking, Will.
I want to know if I need an electricity purifier in my house or something.
Oh, geez. You look on the web, there'll be things for that. I guarantee it. People will be selling you pure electricity. I guarantee that. Yes.
All right. Well, moving on. So today is a special day.
It is. It's the anniversary of Schrödinger's cat.
Silence. What does that mean? No, I'm trying to find this meme, okay? I want to talk about the meme, but I want to get it right. So if you tell us...
No, fair enough.
...what Schrödinger's cat is or was.
Okay, so this all harks back to quantum mechanics. Okay, so the reason we're talking about this today is because...
Yes, actually, because I didn't... You said that it was a study that... It's a study that showed the problem with the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics.
There we go.
And I didn't actually know even what the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics is.
And not many people do.
So should we start there?
Okay, we'll start there. So today in 1935, the paper was published all about Schrödinger's cat. Now, I think probably a few listeners would have heard maybe of Schrödinger's cat, but possibly might not know what... it's all about. Okay.
Well, because it's often used in, I guess, popular culture, right?
Yes, so absolutely
it is. So use a term to describe a certain situation.
It's, it's definitely one of those things people bring up at parties to seem like they know stuff. Anyway.
And then they don't have to explain it because it's just too difficult to explain. So, you know, you wouldn't understand it. So,
but, yeah. Alan, you're going to explain it to us.
Well, I'm going to try my best. So, quantum mechanics is weird, number one. Okay, so back in 1900, everybody thought that they had everything pretty much sorted out and that Newton's laws of matter and everything were all okay and you could describe the entire world and physics was basically going to be a dead science because they knew everything. There was only one thing that they couldn't understand and that was why things give out light when they're excited, okay? We don't need to go into that too much, but there was some studies of that and then somebody comes along, okay, and a guy by the name of Max Planck and he says, no, Newton's wrong. Einstein comes along, says, yep, Newton's wrong. We've got this thing called quantum mechanics now that we're going to use to explain the universe. And quantum mechanics was introduced by Schrödinger and Heisenberg in about 1926. Okay. Now, the whole thing about quantum mechanics is that it is just weird. It's almost incomprehensible. Okay. It's just very, very strange. And it all relies on probabilities rather than the certainties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the weird things about quantum mechanics is that particles can be in many, many, many different states at the same time. And once you observe them, then they're forced to choose one of those states. Okay? It's the act of observation that causes... nature to adopt a particular state, let's say. Okay?
But that state could change tomorrow.
Yes, yeah. So which particular state gets chosen is a matter of conjecture, but it's got to choose a particular state, okay? And this is where Schrödinger's cat comes in. Because Schrödinger sort of thought about this and said, oh, hang on, this doesn't make sense, this whole superposition of states thing, this whole thing that a particle can be in many, many different states at the same time until you look at it. And then when you look at it, it's got to choose one of those states. So he came up with a thought experiment. And thought experiments are great. You don't have to spend any money on them. You sit there thinking about it. That's all that Einstein ever did. Einstein was not a experimentalist. He just did thought experiments the whole time. He imagined himself sitting on a light wave and what he would see if the light wave was travelling at the speed of light. That's how he came up with his theory of relativity.
Is that why you said Einstein and Max Planck talked about it, but then Schrödinger and Heisenberg?
Yep. So... Planck and Einstein started it off, and then Schrödinger and Heisenberg took it to its sort of extremes, and Einstein really never did like it during his lifetime. Okay, so... So the cat. So Schrödinger came up with this thought experiment. We said, right, okay, so let's imagine we've got a cat in a box, and the box has got a hinged lid so you can look inside it. And inside the box with the cat is some sort of radioactive source, and this is going to emit radiation randomly, because radioactivity is a random process, okay? And we've got this set up so that whenever this radioactive isotope decays, one decay, that is then going to trip this hammer, which is next door to a bottle of hydrogen cyanide, and it's going to smash the hydrogen cyanide and it's going to kill the cat.
I didn't know that was to that extent. I thought they just let the cat starve or something.
It's
a thought experiment. It is a thought.
Yeah, the cat. Yeah, you could do anything. Yeah.
No cats were being killed.
No cats were really harmed in the making
There's
of this
no
experiment.
There's no actual cat in the box.
Well, there is, but it's just a thought experiment. They're just thinking about it. Okay, it's never actually done.
Okay. So no cats were harmed in the process.
No cats were harmed in the making of this. Okay. So what we've got the cat there, and it's in with this bottle of poison, and the bottle of poison is going to be broken if this radioactive sample decays. Right.
At a random time.
Random interval. So we shut the box and we wait. Now, is the cat alive or dead? That was the whole point of the thing. Is the cat alive or dead? And the whole guts of this quantum mechanics, this Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, said that, right, okay, the cat is both alive and dead at the same time. And that's the whole Schrödinger's cat paradox. Now, how do we know whether the cat's alive or dead? We've got to open the box and find out whether the cat's alive or dead. Because we don't know, because that radioactive thing, that's a random process. It may have happened, it may have not. We don't know.
Yeah.
But it's only when we open the box and look at the cat, then the cat was in a what we call the superposition of states. It was both alive and dead at the same time. And then as soon as we look at it, it's got to choose one of those. It's got to choose the alive state or it's got to choose the dead state.
I get it.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's not the cat's choice, obviously.
No, it's got nothing.
It's like space time.
The cat's not there, right?
No, the cat's there.
But is there radioactive material in the box also?
Yes, the radioactive material is in the box also, yeah. So we don't know whether it's decayed or not.
So it could have been possible that the cat would have died. They were dealing with a possible dead cat.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But we only know that when we lift up the box and we actually look at it. And that's the same thing as the superposition of states that they're going on about quantum mechanics, with a particle being in a whole lot of different states at the same time. But when you look at it, it's forced to choose one of those states. And so Schrödinger sort of set this up as showing the absurdity of the whole thing, and yet it's been sort of used in the opposite sense to kind of prove that this sort of thing happens, okay, that the Copenhagen interpretation is actually valid. So there's been experiments sort of set up where they're trying to set up superpositions of states, and they've managed to get sort of atoms in superpositions of states and stuff like that, and it's all extraordinarily weird. It really is.
It sounds very very messy, but this experiment, this thought experiment, basically gave them a solid answer, a solid support for that Copenhagen.
It led to actual experiments, I guess, designed at trying to show whether this was the case or not.
What do you think?
Well, the cat's either alive or dead. I know that.
Yeah,
much.
Well, yeah. the thing that
but that's not the point, though, right? The point is that it's both. And so you when you bring that into everyday life and you use this term in a situation, what would be an example of using this on a day-to-day?
On a day-to-day basis, God. It's not the sort of thing that crops up day-to-day, really, does it?
I think the only reference I have is Friends. I think Ross says it at some point. I don't know. I have a meme, though, unless you wanted to say something, Will.
I was just going to say, this is always muddled with my head, because I've just been like, surely the cat knows whether it's alive or dead. therefore...
And therein lies the problem, because the cat then becomes an observer.
Yes.
And that then can
so
possibly...
Who is the observer?
So that could make... That could invalidate the whole thought experiment. So that's one of the things that was said, that, you know, this can't be right, because the cat is then an observer. It knows.
It knows whether it's...
Yeah, it knows whether it's alive or dead. So it's observing itself. So therefore, that kind of throws a spanner in the works. So,
it's just like a really annoying way of thinking about the... If a tree falls in the woods,
I think this has probably kept philosophers, let alone scientists, busy for decades.
A long time.
Yeah,
and it would probably keep me busy for this whole hour if we... Don't move on.
Well,
so.
If I may just quickly.
Yes.
So, okay. So one of the ways that people got around this was to invoke the many worlds view of the universe, okay? And every action you take has a consequence that generates another universe, okay? So when you open the box, you then generate two universes, one universe in which the cat's alive, the other universe in which the cat's dead. And those universes don't talk to each other. So we could be living in these, you know, you have people talk about parallel universes. That's where that all came
from.
That's
all come from this experiment.
Yeah. And the guy that came up with the parallel universes interpretation was a guy by the name of Hugh Everett, who is the father of Mark Everett, who is E from Eels. You don't know Eels?
No,
great
no.
band.
Sorry.
A really, really good band.
Look at total.
Just blank
no
face.
Idea. Yeah. Sorry, guys.
No, fabulous band. So his dad came up with the many words problem. So I just had to get that.
Okay. Fair enough. Didn't know you were a music fan, Alan.
Oof, aficionado. Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Maybe we should get you in for another feature. Just kidding. Okay, we'll keep you on this one. We're not going to see you on this one. The final story, which we should probably speed through.
Indeed.
Alcohol-based hand sanitizer throwing off alcohol breath tests.
Yeah, you'd think this
seemingly
one
would be... Seemingly obvious.
Seemingly obvious. The experiment still had to be done. Some folks in Missouri, they went and tested 65 people using three commonly used breathalyzers that are used in the States. They got the testers to wash their hands with hand sanitizer prior to unpacking the breathalyzer from its packaging and everything, and you know, the mouthpiece and all of that stuff. And then they did the test, and what they found that was 10% of the... Now, these 65 people were stone cold sober, unlike me by the sound of it. And so they got 10% positive tests, and they then got 31.5% of tests where the breathalyzer wouldn't actually register a reading. It screwed it up completely because there was too much alcohol around it.
So this is a risk when people who are doing the test, not necessarily taking the test, but doing the test will muck up with the results.
Yep. And you can imagine if you're a person who is busy sort of taking all these goopy bloody mouthpieces on and off your breathalyzer, you'd probably want to sanitize your hands in between shots, wouldn't you? So,
well, actually, I've never thought about it.
Neither.
Mostly if I've gone through a cop stop and somebody's, you know, holding the breath test, they don't have gloves.
Yeah.
They just have their hands.
Yes.
So they must be doing...
You would think they probably...
Some kind of sanitization because...
Yep.
Oh, this is worrying.
So, but, I mean, as you say, it should be... It seems blindingly obvious, but sometimes the blindingly obvious things are not quite so obvious necessarily. So this has been published in the Journal of Forensic Sciences and,
there you go.
Kind of interesting. Yeah.
It's kind of a cool story. Hmm. But, like... I feel like I'm really nervous regardless of when I go through cop stops. And it's never because I'm actually doing anything illegal. I just have like a crippling fear of
I think
authority.
That's the point. I think that's what the aim of
very
the game
probably.
Is.
I feel like one day I'm going to go through one and they're going to be, have you been drinking? Oh, no. No, not at all.
Well, now you'll say, no, but I've used hand sanitizer.
Ah.
This may throw you off. Did you know it's been published?
Yeah. Brings out the journal from the back seat. Hello, officer.
Alan told me, so actually. All right, we'll wrap it up, but thank you very much, Alan.
My pleasure, as always.
And we'll see you next week.
Will do.
Good luck with the lectures.
Thank you very much. See you guys.
That was Dear Science.